Today's topic is helping clients navigate the modern long-term care insurance policy. Hosted by Jim Wolverton, our Director of Legal Education, and Mary Sizemore, our long-term care insurance specialist here at Cross Financial. First, a few housekeeping items. If you have any questions during today's webinar, go ahead and type those in the questions section of the GoToWebinar toolbar so we can answer them at the end of the presentation. Next, a copy of today's PowerPoint can be found in the handout section of the GoToWebinar toolbar. We also ask that you please complete the post-webinar survey that will pop up on your screens at the end of the presentation, as this is a CLE requirement in order for you to receive your certificate of attendance. And now, let's get to today's presentation. June, Mary, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you so much, Katie. And obviously, this is Jim. I'm really excited to be here, and I'm joined by Mary, who, whenever I have a long-term care insurance question, she's the first person I go to. So I'm really excited to have her on. So welcome, Mary. Thanks for being here.
Looking forward to the webinar today.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Before we get started, for those of you that don't know about Kraus Financial, we are an attorney-led firm that provide asset preservation solutions for estate planning and elder law attorneys and their clients. And we use specialized insurance products, resources, and support to help attorneys help their clients pay for long-term care. And that's really where this webinar falls into play. Is we at Kraus kind of made our name in the elder law business doing Medicaid-compliant annuities, and those are essential when a client is in a nursing home and looking for some relief from the high cost of long-term care, and they haven't done any planning, and they don't have any money, or they don't want to impoverish themselves by paying for that nursing home. So one of the key solutions to being able to pay for the care that folks need when they get to that level is long-term care insurance. And so as attorneys, we're going to be asked by our clients about these contracts. So that's really where this webinar for today comes into play, is to hopefully, by the end of the hour, give you all the ability to better understand these insurance contracts. I know when I was in private practice, and even since I've gone through licensing to sell long-term care insurance, these contracts don't read very clearly, and most insurance contracts do not. It's not like it's a unique bit of characteristic for just long-term care insurance contracts, but in general, insurance contracts are generally a maze of terms that most humans don't use in regular life, and they're very complicated, and, you know, they're very written in kind of insurance language. So what we want to do today and today's goals are really to introduce the structure of a long-term care insurance contract. So if a client comes in with some documents, you know whether or not you're looking at the full contract or not. I know sometimes there'll be different sections of an insurance contract that look like it's the full contract, but it might not be. And then you're talking to the client, trying to interpret it, and you know that you're missing something. Well, we're going to give you kind of the lay of the land on how these contracts are structured, and then we'll dive in some of the policy terms. So as you're giving counsel to a client who either already has one of these long-term care insurance contracts or is looking to purchase one, you can explain to them how these policies work and what the language actually means outside of just the four corners of the contract and in real context. And Mary's going to provide a lot of that context for us outside of just the language of the contract, but kind of how these situations evolve, come to pass, and we can advise clients and what to look out for. Then we'll talk about the benefits, how the benefits are structured in the contract. It's usually on the coverage page. We'll go through that. What to look for as far as exclusions, and then how to trigger those penalties. And so by the end of it, hopefully we will be able to advise clients who are either looking to purchase a policy, or a lot of times, you know, the family might bring in a claim, or someone who's is considering making a claim, and then you'll be able to better interpret the terms, and you'll have a better understanding of how those benefits are triggered and what kind of supporting documentation would be most helpful as a client goes in to making one of those claims. So we're going to go through all that today and really help you hopefully be a better counselor to your clients that are either looking to purchase one of these, already have one, or again, are preparing to trigger a policy claim. So that's kind of where we're going today. And hopefully by the end of this hour, again, you'll be more armed and ready to help those clients that turn to you for help with these contracts. Again, if you do have any questions, please drop those in the question control panel. I have those up, and we'll be able to answer those at the end of the program when we get there. So kind of the first thing I want to do is go through the anatomy of a long-term care insurance policy. Again, I know when I was reviewing insurance contracts for clients, a lot of times you'd get, you know, just a portion of the policy, and then you had to kind of send them back and say, no, this is only one portion. It's, you know, it's referring to other sections that I just don't have my hands on. So it makes it kind of impossible for me to give you any legal advice as to whether or not you're covered in this particular situation. So most long-term care insurance policies, the traditional policies kind of follow the same structure as far as what's included. And we're going to go through and actually look at a lot of these as we go through kind of the policy and the riders and things of that nature. But the first thing you'll want to look at when you get a client comes in with a policy is the benefit schedule. And that's generally a chart that goes through what's covered, what's not covered, and to what extent. And we're going to go through that in detail. Barry's going to help us walk through a benefit schedule from a policy. The next thing you'll find are a variety of different acknowledgments and disclosures. We'll talk about some of those that are really important to keep an eye on. One that is really important is an alternative contact in case the policy premium is due, and we'll talk about that. But looking for that and those disclosures in there to see if anyone was designated and whether or not that person has received the required information so that a payment isn't missed. And we'll talk about what happens if that happens as well. And then you'll actually get to the body of the insurance contract. And this is going to be form documents. And we're going to go through some of the major provisions in there, and we'll walk through those policy provisions, but that'll be policy provisions for that type of insurance policy. In addition to the basic policy, the client will have the opportunity to purchase what are called riders, and those are addendums to the insurance policy itself. These are voluntary. The more riders you add, the more expensive the contract's going to be. The premiums will go up. And we'll talk about two of the more common riders that folks purchase with long-term care insurance. And then something that I think is really important is the submitted application is actually integrated into the long-term care insurance contract, and it's incorporated into the policy. So this is something that with a little bit of distance, you can better help the client who's going in, submitting an application, making sure that they know those answers need to be forthright and they need to be honest, because they're going to become part of the actual long-term care insurance policy contract. And there's provisions within the contract that say if any of the answers on the application are misrepresentations, the insurance company has options to cancel that contract. So depending on the severity of the misrepresentation, how long the policy's been in place, adding in that submitted application into the contract really brings in, and I'm sure if you're a litigator, brings in a lot more wiggle room for the insurance company to get in there and say, well, this application wasn't submitted appropriately. It's part of the contract. You weren't dealing with us as a fair party. And so we didn't have the proper information to base this policy off of. You lied when we created this relationship. So we might be able to deny the policy. So I think knowing that the application is going to be part of the actual insurance policy down the road adds some severity to being honest and forthright on those submitted applications. And I think that that was just kind of eye-opening for me as I was going through the structure of these insurance policies. So that's the traditional policy structure. So those are the documents that you'll be looking for as a full long-term care insurance policy contract. Now, we talk a lot about hybrid policies as well. So a hybrid policy, the way that that's structured, that's where you have a life insurance policy that has a long-term care policy or rider attached to it. And so basically, you can access the benefits of the life insurance if there's a triggering long-term care event. But the structure of that contract is basically two policies. So if you're reviewing those, you want to make sure that you're reviewing not only the long-term care policy or rider, which follows that same traditional structure that we just looked at, but you're also going to want to review the whole life insurance policy. So it follows very similar structure where you have your data pages for the life insurance and long-term care benefits at the top, and then you'll have your life insurance policy. And a lot of those policy terms are going to be very similar to what we'll look at here today with the long-term care insurance provisions. There'll be any riders that were purchased to the life insurance side. And then, again, that submitted application will most likely be part of that life insurance policy. But just to be clear, with a hybrid policy, if you're reviewing one of those for a client, you're going to want to get your hands on the life insurance policy plus the long-term care policy or rider that will follow that long-term care insurance structure that we just looked at. So just be aware of how those are structured and make sure that you have all the information that you need in front of you to be able to review those policies for your clients. Because again, I learned the hard way that, you know, you're a couple hours into reviewing it and you realize you don't have all the documents, and then you kind of have to stop and call the client and try to get the rest of the documents from them so you can finish your analysis. Okay, let's look at that first document that was listed on the policies, and that's going to be the benefit schedule. So this is going to go through a couple of the terms and define how much insurance did you purchase for each of these categories. So some of the terms that we'll cover when we're looking at a benefit schedule, the first thing that you'll see is the benefit period. And so this is the a time that will be covered based on the maximum monthly benefit. So we're going to define what maximum monthly benefit is. But when you look at a long-term care insurance policy, it's either it's going to be a minimum of at least 12 months. And then most long-term care insurance policies, and Mary, if you can correct me if I'm wrong here, generally fall between 2 and 5 years. And this number is going to come from how long would this policy last if we're maximizing the monthly benefit each and every month.
Right.
The policy limit is going to be the maximum amount of money the policy will pay out for covered services. So this is, I like to think of it as a pool of money. When you think about how much insurance am I purchasing, this is really what you want to look at. The policy limit is the maximum amount that will pay out at the time of purchase. And so this is really something that you want to look at. Now, we're going to talk about riders and inflation riders. It's going to help increase this policy limit number. But generally, when the client's bringing you a contract they're looking at to purchase, this is the number that the pool will start at. This is how deep the pool is going to be, to follow our analogy there. The maximum monthly benefit, or you'll see this listed as MMB, is the highest dollar amount paid for all expenses incurred for covered services in a month. So we have, looking back, we have the policy limit, the total pool of money. How much money out of that total pool can be paid each month for each specific service. And this will make more sense when we look at one of the charts, but this is what you want to look at to advise the client. Okay, yeah, you have that pool of money, but you can only access so much each month for each type of service. So we'll look at what that looks like in the way that it's listed. And the way that they tend to be listed out are, what are the benefits at each care location? So you'll see when we look at a chart, it'll have maximum monthly benefits. Sometimes it's uniform throughout all the different service levels. You're able to access the same amount for maximum monthly benefit, but other policies might have a lower amount for home health care. So you'll want to be able to make sure that the client understands until you go to the nursing home, you won't be able to maximize, you know, that policy to the highest extent, but rather you get a lower monthly benefit. So depending on where those services may be provided, that maximum monthly benefit may be different. But a lot of times they're uniform as well. And then they'll also limit some of the different amounts and policy benefits for kind of those secondary services, the respite care, the hospital care. If you're international, how do those work? And then they'll also have associated maximum monthly benefit numbers associated with them. So really, when you're looking at the benefit schedule, you're really seeing how much is this person insured for, again, at the time the policy is purchased generally, and then how much can they access given each month, depending on where they're located and receiving those covered services. Now, when you look into the definition of covered services, as you get to policy language, this is kind of our first little sampling of contract language, and I peppered these throughout the slides just to give you a reference point if you're rewatching this video saying, what did Jim say about that? Let's take a look and see what that language actually looks like. So that language is kind of peppered throughout the presentation. But when we look at the definition of covered services, and you're going to read that and see whether or not the policy is an indemnity policy, which will say that there's a stated amount of dollars that will be distributed for each day or month, depending on how it's written, or is it a reimbursement type policy, which you actually have to actually incur charges, then you get reimbursed for those costs. So in this particular policy, the language that I've sampled here is a reimbursement policy. So you'll see that it reads covered services means services or supplies you receive for which a benefit may be payable under your policy. And then here's the key sentence here. You must incur actual charges in order for services and supplies to be covered services. You're not just going to get a stated dollar amount per day once you've triggered those benefits, but instead it's actually going to correspond with the actual charges you've incurred. So something that you just want to make sure that you understand the definition of while you're reviewing that benefit schedule so you can better guide the client on how payments will come once they trigger those benefits. Okay, so let's look at a benefit schedule. Once we kind of dive into this, I'm going to hand it off to Mary because it does get a little complicated. But up on the top, we'll see our elimination period, which we'll talk about on this particular policy, is 90 calendar days. The policy limit for this policy, and I'll be honest, this is one I purchased last year. So this was my policy, is $180,000. So that's the pool of money for this policy when it was purchased. And then the maximum monthly benefit is $5,000 a month. So for each month, depending, and we're going to go through this on where those services are rendered, $5,000 is the maximum monthly benefit that will be paid out. So Mary, do you want to kind of walk us through how to read this? And how you would kind of explain this to a client?
Sure. So in the next line, it explains that your home health care maximum monthly benefit is 100%. So that's $5,000 per month. And this is a starting benefit, but we always recommend that, you know, before your client were to file a claim, that we get an up-to-date policy schedule, because if they have an inflation rider on here, this $5,000 per month may have inflated to double or even triple of that amount, depending on what inflation rider they have. The assisted living maximum monthly benefit is also $5,000 per month. And again, that's a starting benefit. The bed reservation for assisted living is 100% of the monthly maximum benefit, or $167 per day up to 30 days in a calendar year. And your bed reservation is for a client that perhaps wants to go home, maybe with family for a week or two, for the holidays, and they don't want to lose their benefit at the facility. So they offer bed reservation versus living and also for nursing home. Here is your nursing home maximum monthly benefit. And again, that's at $5,000 per month. The cash benefit starts at $1,250 per month. And that's on this policy, it's automatically included. And it allows your client to access the cash benefit. If they have family members or friends that want to provide care, they can get up to $1,250 per month, and they can use the cash however they want. So if they accept this cash benefit in lieu of the nursing home or home health care benefit versus the living benefit, then this is what they would get, the $1,250 per month. And this does inflate also with an inflation rider if that's been purchased.
So, Mary, it almost kind of changes a reimbursement policy into an indemnity policy, but for a much lower amount per month.
Correct. If you use that cash, however they want, you know, if they want to pay family member or friend, even if it's just for a short time, they can go back and forth month to month to change how they want to receive benefits.
Okay.
Your respite care benefit provides a respite for family. So if your family is providing care, they'll give you up to $5,000. It pays 1 month in a calendar year, so it's up to $5,000 per year. Hospice care, I think we're all familiar with hospice care. It does cover hospice care. International benefit, this is if your client is out of country, it will pay up to 12 months or $60,000. Waiver premium, we do go over that later on in the presentation, and then contingent non-forfeiture, we also go over. Care coordinator, we also go over, and it's something that I recommend that everyone use. Your care managers are know what your benefits are and what care providers are able to give, and they can coordinate all those benefits for you. Alternate care benefit is for something that isn't necessarily defined in your policy. So there may be some new innovations later on down the line, and that would be the alternate care benefit. Stay-at-home benefits, this is designed to help your clients stay at home as long as possible. So they will provide a caregiver training, durable medical, home modifications, if they need grab bars in the shower or a wheelchair ramp put in, or a medical alert system, and that's up to $10,000.
Thank you, Mary. That's really, really helpful. And again, as you're kind of reviewing these with the client, this is really where you're going to sit down with the client, review. Okay, especially if hopefully they're coming to you before they purchase a policy, and you're able to kind of walk through those benefits and is that sufficient for where they're looking to go or receive their benefit? And if not, you know, you can always increase those with the increased cost of premium. But thank you so much, Mary, for making a lot of that make sense for us.
Sure. I wanted to add, too, each policy is different. Each carrier is different. So when you're looking at your client's policy, there's some standard policy language in there, such as the benefit trigger and things of that nature, contingent on forfeiture. You know, there's some standard policy language, but not every policy is the same. So it's important to review each policy individually. You'll see that exclusions may differ. Some of the policy language may differ. So definitely review them on a case-by-case basis. And we do help at Kraus if you do have a policy that you'd like to review.
Yeah, thanks, Mary. That's a good point. We can only teach from one point of view, so we're using a policy to kind of teach that. But if you do have questions, please feel free to reach out and we can get somebody to help you out.
Okay.
Let's look at policy provisions that, again, not uniform in every contract, but you will see versions of these types of policies in most long-term care insurance policies. The first one, and this is the one where most attorneys want to know, and this is their number one question, is can the premiums increase? In most long-term care insurance policies, they will reserve that right. But one thing is to note with long-term care insurance, usually the increase is limited to what's called a full class of insurance policy with proper notice. And a way that a class is defined is everyone that has that same general application date, the same form, issue, age, year, reclassification coverage. So it's like this whole group, class, but it's probably a good word for it, that's listed. And then the insurance company has to go to the state and say, hey, we need to increase this class of insurance. It's no longer financially viable, and we need to increase those premiums. So premiums, generally, they reserve the right to increase those, but they're not just going to increase them on your particular client because your client is now a little bit older. They're a higher risk of triggering a claim. That's what a lot of people think happens with these long-term care insurance policies, but rather they can't do that. There are protections against that, and they have to raise the premium on the full class. They can't just individually target your client and then raise those premiums, which I think is a big misnomer out there in the long-term care insurance world. So here, you can see kind of what the language in this particular policy that we're using as an example, it will have a clause that says premiums can change. The premium for your policy can change. We will not increase premium due to a change in your age or health or use of long-term care coverage. But we will do that per class. We'll give you notification, and we'll talk about what happens if these premiums do increase beyond a certain amount. Again, in most states, before issuing a policy, the insurance company has to disclose all previous class premium increases of that type of policy being purchased. This is before a policy is issued. So before they can sell you a long-term care insurance policy, they have to disclose how often are they increasing these classes of policies. So I had Mary share what this notice looks like. And Mary, you can kind of help us read this once we kind of get through what it looks like. So you can see that this is from a Mutual of Omaha policy. It says, it has sold long-term care insurance since 1987 and sold this policy form since 2013. The company did not increase its premiums on this policy, but has on similar policies in the last 10 years. And then it lists there on the left, and Mary, correct me if I'm wrong, those the long-term care policies, those types of policies that were increased. And as insurance companies have gotten more sophisticated with their pricing and underwriting, you can see a lot of these policies, the years they're available for purchase, were in the late 90s, early 2000s. And then since 2013 on this particular policy, no rate increases since then. Am I reading that correctly, Mary? Is that what you're seeing overall in the insurance industry?
Yes. Overall, rates are becoming more stable. Policy purchased in the 90s and early 2000s, there definitely was some rate increase activity. I think they have more claims data now, and they also have more data just in general. So they're able to make sure that those rates are more stable.
And so you'll want to, take a look at some sort of disclosure like this that the insurance company is required to provide to your clients before they purchase the insurance policy. You can see, what types of policies are receiving these rate increases and have there been any recently that you can advise your clients on that. So if there are substantial premium rate increases, so maybe you have a client that has one of these older policies and they have a contingent non-forfeiture benefit written into them, we can talk about what those options are. So basically the way these are structured is if the premium rate increase exceeds a set percentage, then the policyholder can basically take two options. The first is to choose a reduced benefit amount, and this will continue the policy to then current premium amount or reduce the level of coverage. So we're going to lock in that premium amount. increase, but we're also going to reduce the leverage of coverage from what was expected from the original policy. Or they'll have the option to convert the policy paid up status. And what that means is they won't be required to pay any further premiums, and the policy limit for the benefits will be reduced to the amount of the monthly maximum at the time of the increase. Or, it's easier to kind of understand, that benefit level is going to be capped at the total amount of premiums and we're paid to that date. So if a client does receive maybe a huge rate increase, might be able to help them kind of navigate through these two different options. So the triggering point for a contingent non-forfeiture benefit is generally up to a percentage of the initial premium, and that's going to be based on the issue age of the policyholder. And then kind of the concept here is generally the younger the issue date, the higher the percentage of the increase over that initial annual premium. So I wanted to put this table in here as an example. You can see the triggers for a substantial premium increase that's defined in the contract is the younger they are, the higher that number is. So if you have somebody who's between the age of 40 and 44, for example, this option would be triggered if the initial annual premium is increased 150%. And then you can see as someone whose issue age was 75, which probably isn't going to happen, their percentage, it would be 30%. So the younger the person, the higher the trigger is on those percentages. So this can be a little bit confusing. So Mary helped us put together kind of a fact pattern here where we have Mark, who's 43 years old at issue date, and that initial annual premium, $2,000. So his policy defines a substantial premium increase for his age range as 150% increase over that initial annual premium. So follows this table on the previous slide. If Mark, so 30 years later, at 73, his premium is increased equal to or over $3,000 per year. So that's 150%. The benefit is now triggered. So now he can pick what he wants to do, or he can just continue to pay, you know, that increased rate. So his new rate must be $5,000 or more to trigger that. So Mary's showing us where the math comes from. I'm going to avoid doing math. And if that happens, what are his options? So if we look at his options, we know that Mark has paid $60,000 in premium payments, $2,000 over 30 years. So if he decides, well, I'm going to do the reduced benefit amount option, his premium will stay at $2,000, but his benefits will not be as robust as in the benefit statement. So, yeah, he's not going to get all those benefits, but his premium's not going to increase. However, if he decides to convert the policy into a paid-up status, he won't have to pay any further premiums, but his policy limit's going to be capped, that total pool of money's going to be capped at the total amount of premiums that he paid up to that amount, with the maximum monthly benefit amount capping how much he can get each month. So those are kind of the two options. And Mary, when you run into the situation, what do you generally recommend?
We recommend that they reduce their benefits. You know, taking a paid up policy, while it sounds nice on paper, their benefits are, in this case, would he be capped at $60,000, and looking at the cost of care, that's just not going to go very far. So we do recommend taking that reduced benefit amount.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Okay, so that's what happens. So we know about premiums. They can increase. If they increase beyond those triggering events, now we know what kind of options the client can have. Well, what happens when the payments are due and they're not paid? So this is something that we definitely want to make sure that our clients avoid. And just going back to how a policy is issued is the client submits the application and then has to go through underwriting. And so when someone goes through underwriting, basically the insurance company is saying, okay, you're in good enough shape health-wise that we feel comfortable insuring you. And this is going to be your issue date, and this is going to be your initial premium amount. Well, that's really important in long-term care insurance, because as folks get older, the costs of initial premiums go up, and underwriting can, as people get older, they tend to have more health issues, can be a little bit more difficult to get through. So one thing that we really want to guard with these long-term care insurance policies is to make sure that they don't lapse. And so we want to, when we're talking to our clients about these policies, we really want to understand what are their obligations to make sure the payment's made on time so that they don't lose their policy that maybe they've been paying into for 10, 20, 30 years. And then they have to go back to the drawing board if they wanted to get a new policy at an advanced age where the policy is going to be more expensive and underwriting more difficult to get through. So we're going to look at some of the language that's associated with that particular issue. The first thing we want to look through is the grace period. So how much time is okay to pay, make your payment late? You know, with rent, you have 5 days generally, but it's these insurance policies is a little bit more restrictive until you start getting evicted out of your policy. I'm just going to continue on with my metaphor here. The policies allow a term of days prior to canceling a policy. So they're going to give you that grace period. So long as the premium is paid within the grace period, policy remains in effect. Late period, so long as you fall within the late period, no harm, no foul. However, if the premium is not paid during the grace period, then the language of the contract says coverage will be terminated as of the date of the premium. But there are some options after that, and we'll talk about those as well. So all is not lost if you don't make the payment within the grace period. This particular policy that we're looking at, the grace period is kind of listed in two separate kind of due dates. The total policy grace period is a 65-day grace period. And you go down to the second period, the second paragraph there. If you do not pay your premium within 30 days from the due date, we're going to send you a notice of lapse, and we're going to talk about who that's going to be sent to. It'll be sent to you and the person you may have designated to receive notice of lapse due to non-payment of premium. We'll talk about why that's so important to make sure that you designate somebody. And then from the date of the notice of lapse, you have 35 days to pay that. And if you don't pay it during the grace period, coverage will terminate as of the date that it was due. Will not pay claims incurred or after that date. Grace period does not apply to cancel your policy. So this is kind of, you have a chance to make that late payment. So you have 65 days after payment is due under this policy, kind of under that, kind of that double step process there. However, if you're outside and of that process, maybe your client decided to go out of the country for 6 months. They didn't pay their bills before they left. They forgot about the long-term care insurance policy. They didn't make payment within the grace period. They come back and they say, shoot, attorney, is there anything we can do? What we want to do is look for the language in the contract that discusses reinstatement, because what we want to do is stay within that contract, just reinstate it, rather than starting over a new contract. So what you want to look for is reinstatement language that describes what happens once the grace period is passed and the premium wasn't paid. Generally, the insurance company is going to write in a couple options. Give them a call. Say, hey, will you accept this late payment and continue the policy? That's completely under their discretion. However, if they say, well, yeah, but we're going to make you go through some hoops because you did make this request for reinstatement within whatever number of days is written into the contract. It's generally around 180 days. They might require a new application for reinstatement and make the policyholder go through kind of an expedited underwriting process. So the way that that would work is then you would submit a new application, go through underwriting. So long as your health checks out, they would allow you then to pay all past due premiums. They're an insurance company. They're going to try to make money off you. So they'll charge some interest. But the idea here is rather than starting over a new policy or reinstating that old policy that goes back to that initial premium date, you get all the benefits of that initial premium. Plus, we're keeping this insurance policy in place that would cost a lot more at a later age. So if reinstated, that policy will continue as originally purchased. And that's going to protect the original policy premium rather than starting over at the reinstatement date with the new issue age. And if you have one of those hybrid policies that weren't paid with a single premium, but you're making yearly payments on that, you want to protect the cash value that's growing in that life insurance policy. And if the policy not reinstated as the original policy, now that is just lapsed, it's terminated, and you've lost all the cash value that was in that life insurance policy. So this reinstatement process when a client comes to your office and says, I was out of the country or I forgot to make the payment on this. Is there anything I can do to save it? Or I was short on funds that month. And now I've, you know, come into some cash. I want to get that policy back in place. Definitely review that reinstatement paragraph rather than just assuming that they have to start over. So I did include some of this language. I think the key component, we kind of went through kind of how all this works, but I think that last sentence is important to talk to your clients about, that they, in the event of reinstatement, they may charge interest up to 6% of the overdue premium. So even if you get through the reinstatement process, you might have to pay some interest on that overdue premium. So something to look for. All is not lost. If your client misses the grace period, we might be able to get that reinstated after the grace period has expired. One thing we talked about is that third party who will receive notice other than the policy holder that the premium is past due. And you can update this over any time. So, you know, maybe the person who was listed passes away, there was a divorce, so we want to list somebody else. Kids move, you move. Really important to keep these designations when the policy holder or the designee moves and mail's not forwarded properly. We've all had that happen. And if you're not making a monthly payment, this is highly recommended if you're making annual payments, because those things will slip through the cracks. Again, someone goes on extended vacation, they didn't pay that before they left. Now we have to deal with going through reinstatement. So definitely make sure you designate somebody that's getting these notices that can remind you to make those payments. And again, you can change those. And there's a form generally that's part of those disclosure forms that are initially filled out when the policy is issued. We also want to make sure that if you have a client that comes in that says, well, I didn't make payment because I went through a medical event, and that's why I missed my payment, that's usually allowed. So you do have to make some disclosures to get that lapse cleared and get the policy back in place. So you have to get notice within a stated time generally. And then you have to have a health provider actually conduct an assessment and say, yeah, this person was either chronically ill on or before the expiration of the grace period, and that's why they missed the payment. They will have to make all past due payments will be due, but the nice part here, no additional underwriting needed if reinstated. So if the client, you know, goes into the hospital, doesn't make their payments, we might be able to save that policy. Anything you want to add on that, Mary? I know you had a situation like this that recently came up.
Yes, I just had a son that called in for his mother. She had let her policy lapse, and she was right at the tail end of that 180 days, and she has dementia. So he was desperate to get that policy put back in force because he knows that there's going to be a claim coming up. And it was something, you know, she had paid on the policy for many years. So he was working with an attorney, and I walked him through the steps of getting an assessment, you know, when her cognitive impairment may have started, and then they were going to pay all past due premiums, and her policy was reinstated.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, so all is not lost. It's kind of the moral of this particular section is, even if you have a client that's missed some payments, let's get into these sections of the contract and see if we can save that policy that folks may have been paying into for years and years. We've talked about elimination periods quite a bit, but basically what this is kind of the time deductible. It's the amount of time that must pass before benefits are triggered. Make sure that you're talking to clients about this so this doesn't become a surprise. Most policies, you can choose an elimination period of 30, 60, 90 days. The shorter the elimination period, obviously, the more expensive the premium is going to be. And during this time, the insured is responsible for paying for their care. You can coordinate this with Medicare, and you can actually get a rider added to the contract to waive the elimination period for home health care so you can get benefits for home health care immediately. You don't have to privately pay for the 30, 60, or 90 days. This is some language, some sample policy language that you can see here. And if you read through it, basically what it says, and Mary, correct me if I'm wrong, is you just have to get through this elimination period once under this contract, and at that point you serve your elimination period and that time deductible is met. But Mary, in older policies, it might say something different, right?
Correct. There's different lengths of time to accumulate that elimination period. The more current policies have it just once per lifetime, but it may be that, you know, the policy that your client has where they have to meet that elimination period within 2 years or 5 years. There's also the service day and calendar day. Current policies are usually calendar day, and that means it's going to follow the calendar, and that's important for home care. Service day means it's only going to count the days in which a service was received. So it'll take your client for longer to meet that elimination period. And the elimination period is really one of the most misunderstood features of the policy. The clients don't understand that they have this deductible that they have to meet, and they wish that their coverage started sooner. But in order to keep premiums affordable, you know, we do add the elimination period on there. Usually 90 days is what we're selling with the waiver of elimination period for home care.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Mary. Okay, so those are kind of the key policy provisions that we wanted to review. Remember, premiums can go up, but if they reach a certain threshold, your clients might have some options there. And then if the client doesn't make payment on time, there are some ways to get that policy back in place and then make sure that the client understands the elimination period and what they've purchased. So that's really what we wanted to cover under the policy itself. Now, what happens when your client's preparing to make a claim? What does the policy say about that? And we'll call that triggering benefit. So generally, long-term care benefits are triggered. And the way that this is written in most contracts is they have to be chronically ill. And then there also has to be a plan of care written by a licensed healthcare practitioner prescribing the qualified long-term care services that will be covered. So what's the definition of chronically ill? And again, these are generally uniform in most insurance contracts, but we're gonna cover these as written in the contract that we're using as kind of our example. Chronically ill is a defined term, but generally they have to be unable to perform two activities of daily living, and we're gonna talk about what that means, for a period that is expected to last at least 90 consecutive days due to due to loss of functional capacity, or, so here we have two activities of daily living that's going to last 90 days, or they require substantial supervision to protect themselves from threats to health and safety due to a severe cognitive impairment. So these are some terms, and it's going to be really important for you as the attorney if the client's coming to you saying, hey, should we try to trigger these insurance benefits? You need to understand what all these terms mean. So let's dive into them. Under the chronically ill section, the first thing we need to understand is the person has to be unable to perform at least two activities of daily living. So what are the activities of daily living? There's six of them defined in this particular contract. And again, these are generally pretty uniform throughout. Bathing, continence, dressing, eating, toileting, or transferring. The person needs to be unable to perform at least two of those activities of daily living. And a lot of people will get confused between what's called activities of daily living versus the instrumental activities of daily living. And the instrumental activities are insufficient to trigger the insurance coverage. And this is generally when you'll have a client come in and say, well, mom, she can't do her meals. She can't take care of the house. She's not managing her medicine or the money properly. We took the car away because she can't drive anymore. That's not going to rise to the level of an activity of daily living of these, but it is a sign that their health is declining, and we want to start getting ready to make a claim and make sure that they're getting the care that they need before a insurance claim can be triggered. So this would be insufficient. The instrumental activities of daily living would be insufficient to trigger a policy, but it's something to keep an eye on as you're talking to clients and say, okay, once we've gotten into the inability to bathe or dress or get around or eat, now it's time to start thinking about putting a claim together and making that claim. Another thing you want to make sure as you're talking to clients is, do they need somebody there to provide what's defined in the contract as substantial assistance from another person? And you can see the definition here is it's hands-on assistance without which you'd be unable to perform those activities, or standby assistance meaning the presence of another person within your arm's reach. So this needs to be somebody who's there all the time. Do they need somebody who's in the house all the time to make sure they're safe? This, you know, they're okay for, you know, 2 or 3 days, but by the third day, you know, that's when they really need some help. That's probably not going to rise to the level of substantial assistance that the insurance company is going to require before triggering those benefits. And again, something that you want to make sure that you're reading when you're reviewing the contract is that it states that that situation, that help needs to be rendered for a period that's expected to last at least 90 consecutive days due to a loss of functional capacity. Now, the person might just have a temporary loss of ability, you know, car wrecks, strokes, where they might have a long-term recovery, but it's going to last at least 90 days. It doesn't have to necessarily be a permanent inability to perform those with a long-term care insurance policy, but there's a lot of these chronic illness riders that are now being sold out on the market that do require that the diagnosis be permanent. So this is something that you'll want to look at if someone's bringing a policy to your office and they say, should we make a claim? They're expected to recover, but should we trigger this insurance policy? And if you're reading in there, well, it has to be for 90 consecutive days. Okay, yeah, let's do that. And they might recover in the end anyway. So, Mary, I know you deal with this a lot when you're talking to folks about making claims. Kind of how do you consult folks when they're, you know, maybe in a situation where they might recover?
Sure. Well, it is up to their doctor to determine that 90 days. So, you know, it just depends on the person. You know, obviously, maybe a hip surgery or a knee replacement is not going to last 90 days. But if there are complications and their recovery does last that 90 days or is expected to last 90 days, then the insurance company will usually pay the benefit.
Excellent. The other triggering situation is severe cognitive impairment, which is going to have a different definition that requires substantial supervision to protect themselves from threats to health and safety due to a severe cognitive impairment. That substantial supervision requirement, again, is hands-on or standby assistance. So somebody needs to be in the home to make sure that they're safe. And the severe cognitive impairment is a loss or deterioration in intellectual capacity that's comparable to Alzheimer's or Alzheimer's disease and similar forms of irreversible dementia. So this is really going to be a determination done by a doctor that requires measurement by evidence and standardized tests. Mary, when you see this benefits getting triggered for this, what types of reports are usually being submitted?
I would say, you know, someone who is wandering, you know, a danger to themselves around cooking, you know, with the stove, things like that is when we're seeing that being triggered most often. You know, someone who's maybe just starting to get a little forgetful, that would probably be considered mild cognitive impairment. And we have to wait until their condition got worse.
Gotcha. Yeah, so just be aware of those are the two kind of the triggering thresholds that you have to go through to trigger the benefits of a long-term care insurance policy. So when you go to make a claim, kind of the process to do that, generally you'll have to make a notice of claim. And this can be pretty, you know, informal, where the claim is started by calling the insurance company, or they might tell you, hey, okay, this is to get it started. We have it on file. You made the call, submit the form. Follow our process, and it's generally, you know, through form or through the over the phone or through written form. And then the insurance company's they're gonna conduct their own assessment. So that usually requires providing supporting medical records, those reports of cognitive impairment, And then generally they'll conduct an in-person interview with the person as well. If they're satisfied with that, they'll create a plan of care that'll describe the impairments, the type of care that's needed, and then who's going to be providing the care that they will provide those insurance benefits for. And that's generally done by a licensed healthcare practitioner. And then obviously, if conditions change, we'll have to reassess that plan of care. Mary, when folks are going through this claim process, do you kind of have a standard, I know it's probably different for each insurance company and every client, but kind of a standard time frame that it takes to get through the claims process?
I would say it takes about 30 to 60 days. On the notice to claim, I want to add also that if it's a family member starting that claim and not the policyholder, then the insurance company may require either a signed TPOS in order to release information or a signed power of attorney that's in force.
Right, right. That's a good point. And then the carriers will offer some good care coordination services to help through that. You don't need to meet any sort of requirements to get that, and they can really be robust and really help evaluate the specific care, initial plans of care, and then any subsequent ones that need to be modified, and really, really help coordinate that care to make sure that they're getting exactly what they need, and also help assist with a transition plan, you know, with those folks that are getting better. Anything else to add on that?
I think using the care coordinator is just a way to maximize the policyholder's benefits. They're going to know what benefits are available and what some of the providers are offering. So they're able to, you know, coordinate the two and maximize the benefits to the policyholder. With some services, you do have to use it. But, you know, I think it's in their best interest as a policyholder to use it.
Yeah, it's almost an additional benefit because these are professionals that really know their way around a lot of this stuff that can be overwhelming and confusing.
Right.
Once the claim has been approved, generally premiums, you have to continue to pay your premiums. But one thing to be aware of is as you're going through the claim process, until you're fully approved, you want to continue to make those payments because if you fail to make the payments, that would be the worst time to have a policy lapse. And if, you know, there's payments that have been made after a premium, you know, if the insurance company says, okay, you overpaid, obviously there's reimbursements there. But the thing you want to make sure they tell your clients is if they have a payment coming up, make sure you're continuing to pay those, and then those premiums will be waived once your claim is approved. If you are talking to a client and a benefit trigger has been denied, there are appeals process, and again, we're kind of following the appeals process outlined in kind of our sample contract. But this is where you'll want to look and see exactly what is the appeals process internally that we might be able to help our clients get approved, you know, before we have to start sending mean letters and filing lawsuits. But we want to work through the internal appeals process first. So generally, the client will get a written notice to explain why benefit triggers were not met. Then there'll be an internal appeal process. And again, this is within the terms of the contract. So providing further information and getting as much information in front of the decision makers within the specified date range. In this particular contract, it's 120 days. Once they've gotten the information, then a decision will be made within 30 days. And if that internal appeal is unsuccessful, then in this particular contract, you can take that appeal out to an independent review board. These are done by organizations that are certified by the state to conduct reviews, and that review will be limited to the benefit trigger decisions, and that review is actually paid for the insurance company and a decision in favor of the policyholder, or in this case, your client, if you're representing them through this process, is binding on that insurance company. So definitely make sure that you're exhausting those internal appeals process, if nothing less than to build the case and really understand where the client's at and what they're either chronically ill or they're dealing with some cognitive limitations. So make sure you exhaust those appeals process if you get hired, obviously, within time to make those appeals. We wanted to just talk about a couple common riders, and we've mentioned these. The first is that inflation rider. This is, again, a rider is an addendum to a contract that allows the policy benefits to grow over time to keep up with the rising cost of long-term care services. These can be purchased as simple or compound percentage, kind of the standard inflation rider is 3%. You can purchase them at higher percentages, but again, the premium will go up. And then one kind of rider that you can purchase that will kind of combat the traditional long-term care insurance complaint where it's use or lose it. I don't know if I'm ever going to get any value out of this insurance policy, is a rider that's called the return of premium. And this will allow someone to receive a refund of premiums paid minus any benefits paid out to a beneficiary so long as that policy is in effect when the policyholder passes away. So this isn't going to benefit the policyholder themselves, but they can name a beneficiary to receive that amount of premiums that has been paid so long, subtract out any benefits that have been paid. So a nice way to combat that, again, they are addendums. They do incur a cost when it comes to overall premium, but options there that can kind of maybe help the client process the fact that, yes, I'm doing this important insurance, may not use it, but at least that money's going to go somewhere to a beneficiary. All right. So if you guys have any questions, we're at the top of the hour. Mary, I can't thank you enough. I don't see any questions coming in for your insights and your ability to kind of contextualize some of these policy language. And one thing I do want to highlight is that Mary is available to you and your clients should you have any long-term care insurance questions. If you do have a client that is looking at long-term care insurance or thinking about long-term care insurance as part of your proactive long-term care plan, Mary can work directly with your client, or she can work directly with you, the attorney, if you want to stay in the loop and kind of be the communication between our office and the client. She's more than happy to do that. And then if you're licensed to sell long-term care insurance, we can also work with you and share in a commission there. So if you have any questions about that, please reach out to Mary or I and visit craftsfinancial.com for any additional information. Thank you again, Mary. Very insightful. And hopefully this is helpful for attorneys and their clients that are considering long-term care insurance.
Thank you. Thank you again, Jim and Mary, for your great presentation. And thank you to everyone for joining us today and for completing that post-webinar survey. Have a great afternoon, everyone.